The British journalist William Dalrymple has spent decades reporting from India, and he never seems to run out of stories to tell.
People in America think of India as a country. In reality, it's much more a continent. It contains, like America does, every kind of climate from the high Himalayas through the deserts of Rajasthan down to the tropical south. And within that geographical area, you have this incredible spread of different religious systems, many of which go back to the beginning of man's thought about God.
Those religious systems are the focus of William Dalrymple's latest book. It's called Nine Lives. The nine lives in question are deeply religious people in South Asia. They are Hindus, Buddhists, Sufi Muslims, and more. They include monks and dancers and a man described as a feeder of skulls. Even in the context of India, they take their devotion to the limit. And the incredible variety of belief is what drew Dalrymple to talk with them.
People again talk of Hinduism as if it's a single faith. Hinduism is a vast network of different religious systems and different religious practices.
Now, in one of the early profiles, you meet a woman who is a Jain nun. Who are the Jains?
The Jains are, in a sense, the sister religion of Buddhism. A little bit older. This is the very sophisticated urban world of about 500 BC in the Ganges Basin, at the point when India was way ahead of most parts of the world, except a few cities around the Mediterranean. And this was one of the first great urban cultures of the world. The Jains, while having the same ideas as the Buddhists about wanting to keep away from the pleasures of the flesh and withdraw from the world and find yourself within, had a far more severe route to that. To give just two examples, Buddhist monks shave their heads. The Jains pluck out their hairs one by one in a ceremony that's deliberately painful. Likewise, Buddhist monks can beg, but Jain monks have to just signal hunger by arching their right hand over their shoulder. Beyond that, they're not allowed to ask for food, and they're never allowed to touch money of any sort.
But you meet a Jain nun who's clad in white, and there is a quote that strikes me, because this woman recounts to you that she's supposed to renounce all worldly pleasures, all attachments to anything, but she went and, well, she had a friend. She had a companion.
This was the one attachment that she had, and this was, you know, completely according to the Jain faith. Nuns are not, for obvious reasons of personal danger, not meant to wander around alone. But what my nun, Prasannamata Mataji, had found was that while she'd given up all her worldly wealth, while she'd given up her family, that was wandering the earth, treading as lightly as possible on the earth. They sweep the ground in front of them to make sure they don't step on ants, and they won't step on puddles in case there's some life form that they will hurt inside the puddles. Despite all those efforts that she was making, she did have this one attachment, which was her close friend, the nun who she walked with for 20 years. And when that nun got ill and found that she was dying slowly, she undertook what is for Jains the final stage of Jain asceticism, which, having given up all your goods and everything, you then start to give up food. And it's a process which they do over 2 to 3 years in a very set way that they've been doing for centuries. And, of course, they die. And this is, for them, they say this is not suicide. This is merely giving up one set of clothes to go on into the next life. Because, like the Buddhists, they believe in reincarnation.
There are so many things that are striking about that life and that way of life, point of view that you describe, and yet I'm leading up to something that struck me even more. You speak to this woman who became attached to her companion on the roads, and of course was deeply saddened when her companion, 20 years, and not only was she sad, she was disappointed in herself to be sad. She shouldn't have ever been that close to anybody at all.
Well, in both Buddhism and in Jainism, a lack of attachment also means a detachment. And to be truly detached, you can't love. You can't form close friendships with people. And she realized that she had not followed, in her view, the dictates of her faith because she loved her companion.
And she says, I was punished for that. I formed not just an attachment, but a strong attachment, and that left an opening for suffering. And that's the quote that struck me, because we have gone as far, I think, as you could imagine from the character in the American movie or the American country song who is encouraged to open themselves up and take a chance and take a risk on embracing the world. And this is someone going for the exact opposite
ideal.
This was
really the point of doing this book, because today we live with this illusion that we know the world. The reality, of course, is, and this became very clear after 9/11, that there's huge parts of the world which we know absolutely nothing about, particularly in areas of religion and philosophy. And the veneer of globalization is such a deceptive thing. And the idea that really inspired me with this book was to... India is, you know, these days is a very fast-developing place. You go to India, the economy is going to be overtaking the US by 2050. There are, outside my where I live in Delhi, there are now, you know, the headquarters of Google Asia, mm-hmm. back-office processing units. It's developing incredibly fast. There are, you know, coffee places like Starbucks. All over the world, you have this veneer of globalization, and yet you've only got to rub away that surface veneer. And you find huge, vast differences still in the world. And that, to me, is the job of the travel writer today.
I realize that you went looking among these different religions for professional reasons. You wanted to explain a subcontinent in a different way. But because you were spending time with so many people who were having such deeply intense personal experiences, I wonder if you were seeking anything yourself.
First of all, to make it clear, this was emphatically not a book about my religious search. I've tried as objectively as possible really to tell the stories of nine people and keep myself out of it. But there's no question that over the 25 years I've been there, India and the religions of India have completely altered the way I look at the world. And it's something you don't notice as it happens because it's a slow drip process. But I went to India I have an almost fundamentalist Catholic background. And I went to a monastic school, was brought up by Benedictine monks, had a wonderful education at a school called Ampleforth. But India changes everything. And I think the great lesson of India is pluralism, that it makes it very difficult to believe in only your own faith, that the faith you happen to have been born into is the only possible way of reaching God. The Indian idea that there are many ways up the mountain, I think, is a very powerful one.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
William Dalrymple, author of Nine Lives in Search of the Sacred in Modern India. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
As the oil continues to spill, BP has been widely condemned. But what to do about offshore drilling and the regulation of the oil industry is cause for debate in Congress. Now add to this another dimension, religion. The Southern Baptist Convention has used notably strong language to call on the government and its own congregations to work to prevent such a crisis again. Joining me now to talk about that resolution and the green evangelical movement is Dr. Russell Moore. He is the dean of the School of Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He preaches at Highview Baptist Church near Louisville, Kentucky. And Dr. Moore joins us from the studios of WFPL in Louisville. Dr. Moore, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you today.
Now, you posted on your blog that this oil spill should be something of a major call to arms for evangelical Christians to take action to protect the environment. What's your thinking there? Explain that.
Well, I think that sometimes there are defining moments. I remember once an evangelical figure spoke of the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision as the Pearl Harbor of the evangelical pro-life movement. And what he meant by that was that prior to Roe, most evangelicals really thought of those issues of life and protecting the unborn as being a Roman Catholic issue, somebody else's issue. But then after Roe versus Wade, suddenly evangelicals saw what was at stake and became involved. I think that this catastrophe in the Gulf could be that kind of defining moment.
So, Dr. Moore, why should this be such a rallying cry for evangelicals?
Well, I think for two reasons. One, God cares about the creation. He displays himself in nature. And so the more that people are distanced from the creation itself, and the more that people become accustomed to treating the creation as something that is disposable, the more distance they are from understanding who God is. Secondly, I think that people are designed to be dependent upon creation and upon the natural resources around us. And so in order to love future generations, in order to love cultures, we have to love the ecosystems that support those things. I'm from Biloxi, Mississippi, which is right now threatened by this oil catastrophe. And what's happening is that you have entire cultures and communities of people now imperiled. That's an issue of love of neighbor. And I'll have to tell you, this is the most traumatized I've ever seen my hometown. And I'm including the devastation of Katrina in that. It's kind of like a slow-motion hurricane with no end in sight.
And it's really interesting, the Southern Baptist Convention, which you're a part of, and you helped pass a resolution that they put out on the BP oil spill. And I want to read some of the language here. It called on the government to act determinatively and with undeterred resolve to end this crisis and to ensure full corporate accountability for damages, cleanup, and restoration, and to ensure that government and private industry are not again caught without planning for such possibilities. When I see words like corporate accountability and talking about the government being involved with private industry, I'm very interested in the discussions that led up to this, because it seems to go against some of the political thinking we've associated with evangelicals in the past.
Well, there's really nothing conservative and certainly nothing evangelical about a laissez-faire view of a lack of government regulation, because we as Christians believe in sin. And so that means if people are sinful, if all of us are sinful, then all of us have to have accountability, and that includes corporations. And so simply trusting corporations to go about their business without polluting the water streams and without destroying ecosystems is really a naive and utopian view of human nature. It's not a Christian view of human nature. And so we
But isn't there some division within the evangelical community about this issue?
Yes, certainly. There are divisions in evangelicalism about how we ought to engage this issue and what it ought to look like. There are some evangelicals, of course, who hold to a much more libertarian understanding of the relationship between government and protecting natural resources. But I think for the most part, evangelicals are ready to have a conversation about protecting the creation, and especially younger evangelicals who are just as conservative as their grandfathers and grandmothers in many ways and on many issues, but who also understand that human flourishing means a healthy natural environment. And it simply isn't good for ourselves or for our neighbors to live in a world that is completely paved over and in which every piece of green land is replaced with a Bed Bath and Beyond. That's not how God designed human beings to live.
At the same time, your blog post is calling for a reassessment of the ecological conscience of evangelical Christians. That's coming at the same time that we're hearing folks like Sarah Palin criticizing environmentalists and defending oil drilling in general, that this incident should actually lead to less regulation. I mean, do you see evangelical Christians being, I guess, pulled in a couple different directions here?
I think it's good for evangelical Christians to be pulled in multiple directions. If being pulled in directions means that we're thinking through issues from a biblical point of view rather than from a purely political point of view. And so I think that means that evangelicals can't simply be anybody's interest group. We're going to have some disagreements, but we have to have that conversation. And it has to be more complex than simply parroting slogans.
Dr. Russell Moore is the Dean of the School of Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and is the author of the books The Kingdom of Christ and Adopted for Life. He joined us from the studios of WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you. Very good to be with you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News.